Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. We've got a full complement in the studio and a caller. And sitting across from me, Mike Cosentino.
We are coast to coast today. Mike Cosentino here. Yes, sir. We're doing Democratic Perspective, and we are doing every once in a while we get just downright intellectual, and that's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk to Ashley Dawson on the East Coast. Professor of English in the New York College system, and we're going to talk about extinction. A lot of stuff on the radio.
And Gary LeMaster's here, and we're going to let him talk today.
Good morning.
Ashley, are you online?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning, everyone.
So, good morning.
Okay, give us 1 second. We got the sound and everything. Okay, good. So, Ashley, you've written a new book called Extinction, a radical approach?
Radical history.
A radical history. I think a lot of people know about, you know, the passenger pigeon being exterminated, and they know about the buffalo. People here in the Southwest can see the diminished number of species. There's Merriman's elk, for example, was native to Arizona. The only one I've ever seen is in the Museum of the Natural History in New York, and it's stuffed because there aren't any more here. So people know about large fauna, but tell us if you can paint a portrait of both the breadth of the extinction of species worldwide and the depth at which it goes to, so that folks have a context to understand what we'll be discussing today.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's really great to be speaking with you.
Well, thank you for calling in on July 4th. We really appreciate it. I know it's later in New York than it is here.
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, I think it's a good time when we're thinking about large and important public events to really think through some of the big challenges which are facing us going forward for the future. And I would say that extinction is really right up there with climate change. So, as you said, in terms of the big picture, the rate of extinction, even if we just look at the last half century, is really quite cataclysmic. We've lost about 40% of terrestrial flora and fauna species over the last 50 years. And that rate of extinction, which of course is related to the destruction of habitats, I mean, think about sort of chopping down of rainforests, that rate of extinction is really speeding up. And so it represents really significant challenges for the future. And then you also mentioned in terms of the variety of different species going extinct, I think that's a key point to think about. We all are very aware of the so-called charismatic megafauna. I'm sure you and your listeners will remember when Cecil the lion was killed by that dentist from the Midwest last year. There was such a huge outcry. And obviously, you know, we treasure endangered megafauna like the polar bears and the lions. But this extinction is something that goes across the entire natural world, all the way down to microbes in the earth, of which there are billions. But as a result of climate change, you know, the habitat, the earth is drying out, and so the habitat for those microbes is changing. And science is really not completely aware yet of what's going to happen, but it's not looking good. You know, as habitats change and in many cases sort of dry out, species try and escape and move to other places, but these species are just not used to the kind of time scale that the change is happening on. We're changing things so quickly that it's very hard for species to adapt, and that's one of the key reasons why this extinction is such a catastrophic one.
And I think a lot of people tend to forget what's happening in our oceans, that the extinction is going on in the oceans just as much as it is on land. We have the Great Barrier Reef now in great peril.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you're right. The oceans remain the kind of great other for human beings, the place we usually don't think about, but the changes are really shocking. I mean, we're acidifying the oceans. As we put carbon into the atmosphere, one of the great sinks for that carbon, of course, is the oceans. A really significant percentage of the carbon that we emit goes into the oceans, and so much, in fact, is going into the oceans that we're changing the pH balance. They're becoming more acidic. And that's maybe not linked directly to the bleaching of coral. I think that has to do with changing temperatures and the warming of the oceans. But the acidification of the oceans is just as important because as the oceans grow more acidic, small organisms that really are at the base of the food chain in the oceans that need to form shells can no longer do that.
Ashley, do scientists have a calculation? I know we're still discovering new species. I think they looked at, 10 or 12 trees in Panama and came up with 12,000 species of beetles or something.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even know how many species there are. I mean, we have a general idea. Do we have information, scientific information, on the impact of human beings and our impact on, climate change is one thing, on the decimation of the variety of species, the biodiversity of the planet?
Well, we're learning more all of the time. For instance, about a month ago, the Botanic Garden in Kew Garden, one of the most important botanic research centers in the world, published the State of the World's Plants. But to give you an indication of how much knowledge we still have to gain, this was the first ever report on the State of the World's Plants. And one of the most interesting things that is contained in that report is that the attempt to really quantify the variety out there is most developed in the most wealthy areas of the world, you know, in North America and in Europe. And the places which actually we know have the greatest biodiversity, that is the tropics, you know, places like the rainforest in the Congo or Indonesia or the Amazon, those places are underfunded in terms of their scientific establishment. And consequently, we really don't have developed enough sense of what we're losing. And the way we do it, as you just mentioned, is to look at a small kind of transect, you know, a small area, and count the number of organisms in that area, and then look at how much of the more broad habitat has been chopped down, you know, how much of the Amazon, for instance, is disappearing every year. And then we just sort of do the math and figure out how many species we're losing. So that's how we calculate things. But it's not based on a kind of really holistic catalog. And there's a lot of stuff that we just don't know about, which is out there.
Why should we care? Why should we care about the extinction of species? You know, we have battles out here in the Southwest with the Mexican gray wolf. This is the most endangered wolf in North America. And we've had people on our show talking about the gray wolf. And one of the things they said is that, like you said, is the gray wolf is a beautiful, charismatic creature. And it's at the top of the food chain. And there's a huge battle, political battle here about saving the wolf. I mean, there are people who just mm-hmm. want them all dead, and there are not very many of them.
Mm.
Why should we care about this? I mean, people seem embedded in their own problems, Ashley. They seem worried about, you know, whether they're going to lose their job or something. It's a reach for them to worry about something this important but so general.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, I guess I would say that ultimately the reason we should care is because we're connected to all of these other organisms. And that idea of kind of connection and solidarity has a whole variety of different kind of quite concrete ramifications. I mean, to take one instance, biologists have begun to realize that when a keystone species like, for instance, the wolf disappears, there's a whole kind of cascade throughout the ecosystem, and the whole ecosystem becomes impoverished. You know, the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone over the last few decades has shown that the extermination of wolves, which was a product of the arrival of settler colonials in North America, you know, who wanted to protect their cattle, led to a real impoverishment of the ecosystem. Basically, it meant that the wolves were no longer hunting the large grazing animals, and when those animals didn't have a predator going after them, they just kind of ate the ecosystem to a very large extent and impoverished all the other forms of life that depended on that ecosystem. So there's a way in which just one species going extinct has a much broader impact on the whole ecosystem and impoverishes it on some level. And, of course, we depend on those ecosystems, right? There are all sorts of uses that we get from ecosystems that are very important to us and which are important for the future. But there's just a couple of other ways, which I'll go through very, very quickly. I mean, one thing has to do with just a basic kind of ethical question. What does it mean for us to be destroying so many of the other creatures, the flora and fauna, which exist on the planet? If we think about them as having some rights of some kind, shouldn't we want to protect them? And I mean, think about the fact that when most children are learning to read, they read books that have images of animals in them as a way of kind of learning how to be social and to be connected to other people. So if we lose that ethical connection to the rest of the world, I think it has profound political implications for the way that we behave on the planet, and it doesn't spell a good future for all of us. And then the second point that I would make kind of comes out of that, and that is that the extinction crisis, I think, is one of the most prominent aspects of what we're doing to the planet today, and I've already mentioned climate change. I think we could think of climate change more profitably as a kind of mass extinction crisis where we're really driving the planet to the point where most of the life on it is going to ultimately disappear. Of course, it'll come back millions of years later, but not on any time scale that we can appreciate. So extinction, it seems to me, is a very visceral way of engaging with the crisis that of our times, the great environmental crisis of our times, and it has to be related to concrete issues like jobs. Obviously, we need to make a shift into a different way of being on the earth, and we need to come up with jobs that support that rather than jobs that continue to drive humanity and the rest of the planet to the brink of extinction.
Doesn't it go beyond climate change, though, in many respects? Climate change, for whatever reason, is still somewhat controversial. But it goes into this whole destruction of habitat. We see it in the Southwest, and I used to see it when I lived in Minnesota, where wherever there's a wild area, a wilderness, people just can't leave it alone. They have to the commercial interests have to look at it as resources that are just there for our taking. The recreational people have to take their ATVs and whatever and use the environment destructively for their own amusement. Aren't there a lot of facets to this whole extinction?
Yeah, well, I think it's important perhaps to challenge the way in which the idea of nature has been set up in the United States historically. You know, I mean, the movement for conservation goes back over 100 years ago to preservation of parks like Yosemite and Yellowstone. And we kind of think of those spaces as kind of completely inviolate, untouched spaces. But when they're originally set up, they were set up with the kind of goal of having them as gentlemen's hunting spaces so the elite people of the time could go and, you know, shoot deer and bison, and so that big logging interests could come in and chop those places down. So the way in which nature was constituted was kind of schizophrenic, right? On the one hand, we have this idea of completely setting aside a totally untouched area. And then, on the other hand, we wanted to have particular people gaining access to it and not necessarily the general public. And I think that that kind of legacy is problematic on a whole lot of different levels. I mean, first of all, indigenous people get turned invisible by that idea of nature being completely untouched. You know, they, of course, had been husbanding those areas, stewarding those areas for many, many thousands of years in a way that was sustainable. And what we kind of ended up doing was creating a quite divisive idea of nature and not really thinking about ways in which we could have sustainable relationships to nature all around us, including in the cities that we live in. You know, cities are usually seen as the opposite of the natural world, but we need to make our cities more sustainable and more of a habitat of various different kinds going forward into the future. And, you know, what I try to do in my book is to argue that ultimately the root cause of all of this, that's why my book is a radical history, is the fact that we have an economic system which is based on ceaseless expansion on a finite natural resource base, and that if we want to get to the root of this crisis, we need to change our ideas about our economic system and the kind of cultures of consumption that come with it.
Well, your book is a call. I'm like climate change. This is Mike Cosentino here. I'm at least as radical as you are. To those of us that look at the information on climate change, that the whole argument, it becomes moot when hundreds of millions of people are refugees and the coastal cities, you know, two-thirds of the world's population lives on the coast and it's underwater. Then the argument will finally stop. And same thing, I believe, as you mentioned in your wonderful discussion here, the connection between the culture of capitalism and mass extinction. And we're losing 100 species a day of plants and animals. And I don't care if you are the most non-scientist, radio station owner in the world, that's going to have an impact on your life. Most of us sit around and say, well, I'll be dead before it has any, impact. But I'm not sure that that's a response either. Your solution, your solutions are the radical part, I guess, if you want to, at least the radical political part, that once again, like climate change, mass extinction calls for a green economy in which there's plenty of jobs and there's plenty of opportunity and there's plenty of profit. All we have to do is change the culture, Ashley. So get busy. You're the professor guy. Change all those young minds and have them abandon this whole capitalist thing so we can survive, so us old guys can hang out a little while longer.
I'm doing my best with that, and that's why I wrote this book. I hope it does change some minds, and, you know, it's great to be able to be on your radio station, hopefully get the word out that way. But we definitely face some odds. I mean, you refer to the fact that there's some debate about climate change. Of course, within the scientific community, there's no debate whatsoever.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
It's important to know that there's a history here of very well and sort of deep-pocketed sponsorship of climate change denial by big corporations like Exxon, who are invested in continuing with the current unsustainable model of resource extraction and planetary despoliation, and that they use the same advertising agencies which Big Tobacco used to spread doubt about the impact of cigarette smoking, which, as we know, you know, has killed millions of Americans and is killing people all around the world today. It's really criminal behavior, and I personally feel that we should indict those large fossil fuel corporations and, essentially nationalize them and use
Exxon
their money to make a green transition. I mean, we know we can't keep burning fossil fuels. Of course, coal is the worst, but all the other fossil fuels are doing terrible damage to the planet and to the species of the planet.
But
so
you'll
a big shift.
You'll talk to a coal truck driver in southern Utah that blames Obama, that will scream at the mention of his name for taking his job. So there is... I mean, there isn't, you know, I don't know how you get universal or at least consensus on this. Obviously, we know why we didn't get it on climate change, because as you've just said, there was this paid, very well-funded anti-denial, this denial campaign regarding climate. But in 2016, the information now, just like mass extinction, is irrefutable. I mean, these are voices. The deniers are voices in the wilderness, not the people, the scientific evidence that, as I said, in a very short time, all the climate change people are going to have the satisfaction of seeing hundreds of millions of refugees and destruction of coastal cities. I mean, you know, it's going to be that simple. It's a race to see which islands are going underwater first, which, you know, 20 million people in Shanghai, are they going to go first? Are we the L.A. basin? I don't know. And these things are happening now as we are having this show.
Mike likes to think about this because we're at about 3,000 to 4,500 feet here at northern Arizona.
Well, the joke, of course, has been for 50 years about, you know, tying up your boat in Arizona and how much our land is going to be worth, but there's going to be no economy, so the land is not going. So my acre and a half at 3,300 feet is not going to be able to sustain 6 or 7 million people that are going to be wanting to live there. So
according to scientists, there have been 5 mass extinctions in world history. And many people who studying extinction of species say this is the sixth extinction. And the sixth extinction is caused mostly by human activity rather than by any kind of natural process. I mean, we're all pretty much familiar with, you know, asteroids hitting the planet and knocking out hundreds of thousands of species. Do you think this is the sixth extinction? Is it that serious?
Yes, it is. And I have a couple of comments relating to that, but let me just go back to something that I think Mike was saying about, the coal truck driver and her or his concerns about some kind of a loss of jobs and a shift into a different kind of economy. I mean, I take those concerns seriously, and I think part of the problem is that we've been so won over by the ideology of there is no alternative, right? TINA, which was the acronym that Margaret Thatcher invented, but, you know, has become part of our current neoliberal orthodoxy, that we can't really take seriously the idea to plan for a change and to think about where the jobs for people in the fossil fuel sector are going to, go. But you were enumerating all these massive changes we've got coming our way, including the rise of sea levels, which is going to affect coastal cities in the United States and also around the world. So I think we really need to plan for these changes. You know, we need to plan for an energy transition that gives people jobs and that leads to democratized sustainable energy. And, you know, we need to plan for big population movements, even just within our own country. I mean, people are already abandoning the Delta in Louisiana and their indigenous people in Alaska who are having trouble surviving because the oceans are eating away their villages. So this is not just a problem of the right, which, of course, sees the state as always anathema, but too much of the left, I think, has accepted that view. And so I think part of our work really involves shifting those perspectives.
That's a good point.
Trying to articulate a better kind of future. And of course, that bears on conservation as well, right, because there are a limited number of real hot spots of biodiversity around the planet, and they tend to be in relatively poor countries. And there's very little support for those areas at the moment. And so we also need to think about ways in which we, as a species, might want to help those areas and the people who live in them be able to sustain biodiversity there. But to come back to the issue of the sixth extinction, I think that, yes, you know, the rates of extinction that I mentioned, sort of that we talked about at the outset, really do bear on the idea that this is the sixth extinction in the history of the planet. Probably the previous one, which your listeners are most familiar with, is the extinction that led to the extinction event that led to the loss of the dinosaurs when an asteroid hit the planet around what is now the Yucatan Peninsula and led to, you know, pollution in the atmosphere and the death of all of the dinosaurs, and to essentially the beginning of the kind of dominance of mammals on the planet and to our dominance as a species ultimately.
Hold your thought, Ash. We're talking to Ashley Dawson, author, professor, author, and of Extinction, A Radical History. And the review in the LA Times says this book is aimed at the non-academic. So I'm not sure exactly what that means or if that's a good thing, but it is a good thing. Okay, go ahead with the extinction that we're most familiar with is the dinosaur, but we also see the polar bears floating, dying off, and we're supposed to care about that. And your book discusses in wonderfully the you call it the megafauna, that saving these large animals is a cost and a self-deception, more importantly, which is where I know your argument is going right now. This whole, you use the word neoliberalism liberally, and it's a good term politically, that the solution. So here we are chronicling all these disasters on the show this morning, and that you do in your book, but the solutions are political, the solutions are cultural, and unfortunately, Ashley, those that aren't exactly, that I recall, how can we quicken? Is there a quick, I don't know, is there a revolution here? Is Bernie Sanders going to save us?
Well, I think it's important to remember that there are social movements all over the place that are resisting what's happening. I mean, one of the great tragedies of the sixth extinction and of climate change, too, of course, is the kind of ethical gap between those who are involved in it and those who are going to suffer the most. And usually that ethical gap is sort of in terms of one based on time. You know, in other words, what we do now is going to affect our children, our grandchildren, and future generations much more than it affects us. And so that's one way of thinking it. But I would say also another kind of gap is a kind of geographical gap, and that is that still most people in a wealthy country, a relatively wealthy country like the United States, are fairly insulated from the impact of extinction and from climate change, but that's not true of people in a place like Bangladesh or the Amazon rainforest, where massive transformations are happening right now. And people in those areas are fighting in various different ways, not necessarily always progressive ways, but, you know, there's a lot of resistance to what's happening right now.
That's true. I saw something, I think, on a public station about the inhabitants of the Amazon refusing government money to do their environmental work. And in this particular case, it was oil spills back at the headwaters of the Amazon, you know, which supports, you know, as Steve was saying earlier, you know, there's still thousands of species yet to be discovered in the Amazon, and yet the environment's getting destroyed. Some of these locals, as you were pointing out, have this movement. I mean, these, you know, these are not professors in the New York State college system, are working tirelessly to try to clean up these oil spills and point out the oil spills and get public information out on the oil spills and the damage. So I was amazed to see this movement deepen, and yet they were just as committed, just as radical, and the fact that they turned down government funds because to accept government funds would mean to accept government corruption.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, you know, in my opinion, the real political change that we challenge that we face is connecting movements like that in what gets called the kind of the global south in developing countries, where people are what the critic Ramachandra Guha, who is an Indian critic who writes very interestingly about environmental struggles in India, of which there's a long tradition. Of course, you know, Gandhi can be thought of as part of that tradition. He calls people in the global south ecosystem people, in the sense that they depend on the environment in a kind of really, really direct way, that perhaps people in cities, you know, in your state or in the United States in general don't. But so the real political challenge, I would say, would be to connect struggles by ecosystem people with struggles here in a developed country like the United States. And, you know, for me, as someone who lives in New York City, that challenge is very present, you know, because of Hurricane Sandy and the way in which it was predominantly poor communities who suffered during Hurricane Sandy. And, of course, you know, we know from Hurricane Katrina that this is a phenomenon which is not specific to one place in the United States, but that there are very many vulnerable sites to cataclysmic forms of damage related to climate change and to the extinction crisis. And then, of course, there are sort of slower moving things. You know, poor communities in New York City have some of the highest asthma rates in the entire country because of the fact that there's so many power plants and other polluting industries sited there. So there's a real possibility, I think, for making links between people interested in real kind of life and death issues and struggles here in a place like the United States to communities in the global south that are fighting against habitat destruction and consequently fighting against extinction.
Let's take the example of the Amazon, and you have giant ranching corporations moving into the Amazon. They're clear-cutting the forest, which is sort of the called often, I don't know if it's accurate, but the lungs of the planet. And you also have small landholders or basically small people in the sense that they have little resources, and they're chopping up the rainforest too. And I think that the libertarian model is that if everybody pursues their own personal limited interests, everything just works out fine. But when you look at the rainforest, all of this leads to a destruction to the rainforest. I would suspect it would lead to climate issues, even in the people who are clearing the rainforest. Now, from their point of view, they need food. They need a place. They don't have anything. They're moving into the forest. It's a classic thing. The indigenous people are in their way. They're chopping down. They're recreating an environment that will produce them food because they don't understand how the forest can produce food, and it can't produce enough to support them. So all these individual actions are going on, and the result is a massive destruction of the rainforest. So how do you relate to people who are on this track and being driven on this track to be able to break some of the environmental damage going on? And we're talking about, like, as you said, the most sensitive areas on the planet, the ones with the most species are in the ones who are sort of beyond the reach, really, of Western conservationists. They're really, the fight's going on. It's very dangerous to be a conservationist in Amazon.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a really good point. One of the main reasons I wrote my book was because of my reaction when I read Elizabeth Colbert's book, The Sixth Extinction, which is a really wonderful survey of, or really depressing survey, depending on your perspective, of current examples of extinction around the world. So if anyone wants to see a whole series of contemporary examples, they should definitely take a look at her book.
Elizabeth
but
Colbert.
At the end of the book, she sort of, she tries to come up with an analysis of why extinction is happening. And she says, you know, if you want to understand what's driving extinction, you should look at the person in the Amazon with a machete or at the guy on the savannah in Africa with an AK-47 hunting lions, or you could look at yourself, dear reader, with this book in your lap. And I kind of appreciated what she was saying about trying to think about the different places where extinction was happening and spread responsibility around. But in my opinion, that really doesn't get at the genuine responsibility that the global 1% bear for extinction. I mean, the example you bring up of the Amazon is a perfect instance of that. Why are these small farmers doing what they're doing? It's because they're poor. And why are they poor? It has to do with the history of colonialism in Brazil and the way in which the land was given to a relatively small number of people. You know, the rates of land possession by just a few big families in Brazil are really quite shocking. And so it's those interests that are behind poverty in Brazil. It can be transformed. You know, the Workers' Party, which was in power in Seoul just about a month ago, had quite progressive policies and diminished the rate of poverty in Brazil. And as a consequence, or connected to that, deforestation really kicked down significantly. But they've been under a lot of pressure. They changed the laws about 3 years ago, and rates of deforestation in the Amazon started going back up again. And now, of course, the president, Dilma Rousseff, is being impeached and is kind of locked away in the presidential mansion. And we have a regime in place which is completely a kind of creature of these big ranching interests.
But they had powerful global forces by that I mean corporations working against them down in Brazil. So I don't know how much is true, how much is. But I want to change gears here for and hopefully they won't grind as we do here. Get us back to your way. Tell us about the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the oldest recorded human stories on the planet. And you use it as evidence for your book.
Yeah,
I read it in the original.
as I say, my book is a history. It's a radical history, as the subtitle suggests. So I really go through a great deal of time in the book, and I try to use particular examples to give readers a flavor of what I'm talking about and to anchor them. The arguments that I'm setting forward. So the Epic of Gilgamesh is the first recorded example of a kind of literary work that we have in human history. It was created in the ancient Sumerian dynasty about 5,000 years ago. And it really records the destruction of trees in the area around Babylon, you know, in what is now Iraq, through Syria and Lebanon. So it seems that the Sumerian Empire was driven to cut down a lot of the trees in the region, and because it wanted to expand, because elites in the empire wanted to be able to engage in these kind of spectacular forms of consumption. And so what I argue is that that environmental degradation eventually led to a collapse of the empire, and it happened pretty quickly. And I also talk about the Roman Empire and the way in which the policies of bread and circuses led to just really shocking rates of destruction of animals. You know, after the Colosseum was opened, something like 9,000 animals were killed each month or 3 months in a row as part of these gladiatorial spectacles. So I do talk about previous examples in history of these sort of destruction of wildlife and the way in which that was connected to the crash of civilizations. But what I want to argue, and if readers get the book and go through it, they'll see, what I want to argue is that these collapses were regional. And even if the Roman Empire was quite big, it was basically just the ancient Mediterranean. And what we're faced with now under a capitalist system which dominates the planet is the threat of a real global crash, a real global extinction of life.
Well, that's true. We read about these sustainable communities somewhere, you know, maybe sustaining 10 or 20,000 people via solar energy, compared to the mass problem that we're discussing, which requires, according to Ashley Dawson, a mass solution, and that a cultural shift as it were, away from capitalism and all that it and just saying any anti-capitalist. We before the show, you know, Steve and I were arguing the more radical, but even using the term anti-capitalist, you lose about 30% or 50% of your readers, no matter how convincing your argument is. Don't get me wrong, I think the term is accurate and well used and exactly the direction you need to take.
How does, in your argument, Ashley, how does capitalism become the driver of the extinction of species and stuff? What's the structure of that? And we have a few minutes, Tom. We have 4 minutes to explain all of that. Well,
okay. There are a number of different facets, but let me just make it very simple. And basically, it's the idea that capitalism is based on remorseless competition and expansion, right? Capitalism has to expand as an economic system. And other cultures and economic systems haven't had that imperative. But, I mean, even for people who are turned off by the idea of anti-capitalism as a kind of dogma, surely they would admit that the way the capitalist system works is that you have to compete and in order to survive. And so what I argue is that is just impossible to sustain on a finite resource base. We live in one planet, and people in North America are already consuming at the rate that would require many other planets. You know, it's just they're drawing on resources from other places. And so what my book does is to go back historically and show how this dynamic of capitalism has led to crashes in the number of species. So just to take one example, I look at the whaling industry and the way in which in the 19th century the whaling industry became more and more industrialized, so that, you know, what originally was just a couple of guys in a boat, you know, close to shore, became this really industrialized enterprise with massive steam-powered boats going all over the planet with huge crews and, you know, harpoon guns and essentially hunting whales to the point where the number of whales that were left in the ocean could not support the industry anymore. So that by the early 20th century, the whaling industry largely crashes. So that's an example in microcosm of what we're doing to the planet in macrocosm. You know, it would have made sense for these whalers to regulate their catch and diminish it so that the whales could reproduce and so they would still have enough whales to hunt and so they could sustain their industry. But they didn't do that because they were competing with other whalers. They're competing with other whaling fleets from other countries, and so they just basically hunted all the whales to the brink of extinction.
We're talking with Ashley Dawson, who's a professor of English at the Graduate Center of the City of New York. He has a number of different specializations, but he's written a new book. It's just out, called Extinction, A Radical History. It's available online from the publisher, OR. I got it for $10, a cyber version, and I think it's being sold for $12 in paperback. So it's not a huge book, and it's not an expensive book, and it's one I think that it's not too technical, right, Mike?
Well, yeah, it certainly is. I do want to. It certainly is accessible, and it certainly is current, and it certainly is a lot of information, and that's now. That's important. I want to mention a couple other things that the LA Times great review of the book mentions: Flightways, Life and Loss, and the Edge of Extinction. This is Thomas Van Doren's book. That it takes a little more, maybe, of a literary approach to the same subject. If Ashley's Dawson's too scientific, we want to thank Ashley for calling in this morning. We want to thank Democrats of the Red Rocks for being great supporters of us. We want to thank Ledbetter Law. We want to thank all those fine and wonderful people that give us the resources to keep Democratic Perspective on the air. We have our podcast. This and all our shows are available at vvid.org. Please go to our website, our very beautiful Democratic Perspective website, and you can catch our old shows. And in a few days, you can catch this show. vvid.org has our podcasts. Thank you, Ashley. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you so much for having me on Democratic Perspective.
Good talking to you, Ashley. We just wrapped up. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.